This is Popular Front, a podcast focused on the niche details of modern warfare and underreported conflict with me, Jake Hanrahan. This episode, we're speaking to journalist Ali Winston. He's going to be speaking to us about a bizarre case where a US military soldier is currently in court and is probably going to go to prison for the rest of his life because he is a, no joke, neo-Nazi satanic occultist who is a member or is acting on behalf or under the influence or ideology of the occult group Order of Nine Angles. He tried to blow up his whole unit. It sounds mad, but it's true. If you like what we're doing here at Popular Front, please support us at patreon.com/popularfront. So you've been looking into this very serious but almost like stranger than fiction case where a US soldier who is a neo-Nazi and adherent of Order of Nine Angles, the far right satanic esoteric occult order, he was planning to blow up his own unit, right? What the fuck?
This is probably one of the stranger cases I've covered in 5-6 years covering the far right in the States and elsewhere. But to be honest with you, it was pretty real. And I mean, I can't, the deeper I got into it, the more, the clearer it became that the feds and the military were freaked out by this case. It to them represented kind of the ultimate insider threat. So what happened is Ethan Phelan Melzer is a young 20-something man from Louisville, Kentucky, high school dropout, not necessarily the sharpest tool in the shed, kind of dabbled in like, old, you know, edgelord style shit when he was younger. He was allegedly, you know, from court filings, it shows that he, you know, dealt weed. He allegedly robbed people during drug deals as part of, you know, what he claimed was some role linked in with a gang in Louisville, a couple different blood sets. He apparently shot two people as part of one drug deal gone bad in near his apartment complex. And the second one was allegedly a robbery elsewhere in Louisville. And then he also claimed to participate in like some anti-fascist group in Louisville. So he was kind of playing around with different ideologies. And then when he went into a Job Corps program, this kind of federal jobs program for young people who don't really have much of a background and kind of trying to get them to finish their education and give them some work experience, that's when he purportedly got involved with the Order of Nine Angles. It's not clear how he was first exposed to the group and the ideology, but it seems like he kind of self-radicalized through the internet. And then over time, basically straight out of the Job Corps program, he enlisted in the U.S. Army and joined the 173rd Airborne Combat Brigade. And it was while he was in service there that he really kind of deepened his ideology and understanding of this far right, very at one point obscure, but I think it's a little bit less so now, the Satanist sect. And then through a couple different Telegram groups that were run by like-minded Satanists and far, you know, right-wing extremists, he kind of delved, he got through one circle of it, you know, he started hanging around with people of a similar ideological bent of his own. And then as he got deeper and deeper into that world, he made common cause with a couple people who he believed would help him carry out a quote mass cal event, a mass casualty event, whereby he would get his unit attacked, his combat unit attacked during a forthcoming deployment to a U.S. military base in southeast Turkey. And I believe May or June of 2020, I think it was June of 2020 is when the expected deployment was. So yeah, he was the military investigators, criminal intelligence investigations units, and the FBI got wind of this plot ahead of time. They were tipped by an informant who was inside of the Telegram groups that Melzer was organizing this attack in. Apparently, that's what the court records say. And he was arrested before any of this could take place. But as part of his case, he sent, it was revealed that he sent extensive information about his unit to this kind of small group of co-conspirators, which included, you know, of course, an autistic Canadian teenager who claimed to be a former member of a combat parachute regiment. You know, there's always somebody with a pretty serious mental illness in these groups.
Yeah.
Whether or not they're dangerous, that can't be said, but it's just, it's a really unfortunate feature of this world. And then there was another individual who claimed to be both a member of the Bozkurts, the Turkish Grey Wolves, a ultra-nationalist fascist organization that is very widespread throughout Europe, Turkey, and the Turkish diaspora. And also, you know, had links to Al-Qaeda. And the intent of Melzer was to get enough information about his troops' movements, their armaments, their positions, their radio channels, the actual topography and fortifications of his base, that his unit would either be attacked on their way to or in this outpost, wherever it was. And he was convicted. He pled guilty, changed his plea in late June, third week of June of this year. He was staring down a trial. They were putting together voir dire and the witness and exhibit lists. They were set to go in the Southern District of New York, which is, you know, the number one, the highest profile terrorism. It's kind of the highest profile federal jurisdiction, federal district in the country, and it's where most of our terrorism trials happen. So this was a very, very, very high profile case. And at his change of plea verdict, I was in the courtroom for that and several other hearings. I was actually surprised, because beforehand it was mostly like it was a couple government lawyers, defense investigators, the defense team, so forth. When I got off the elevator at the courthouse, the federal courthouse in the financial district in Chinatown, I was shocked. There was a full hallway. And it was pretty clear that these were all feds. They were cops. Mm. Like, these were FBI agents. It was the member of the national security team that had kind of done the investigation into Melzer. And they were waiting to see him kind of admit that he did everything. Like, this is what he was about. So he's going to be sentenced in January, I believe. And he's looking at decades in prison. I mean, he might take 40 years, if depending on how harsh the judge is with him, but he's going to be an old man when he gets out of prison.
Yeah, good. Let's go back a little bit. So you said there, this guy Melzer, he was involved with like gangs like the Bloods and stuff like that. So that's what he claims. Is there any evidence of that, or do we know if he's just fucking around or like what?
So this was one of the more interesting developments in the court filings that came out. I want to say, when was that filing dropped? I think it was dropped at some point over the winter or the spring of this year. Mm. You know, I make a point of tracking certain dockets and the filings in these cases. And I believe that this was an evidentiary motion. They wanted to drop, the defense was trying to get the government to drop, or the judge, to exclude evidence of his, of Melzer's claims to have participated in the Order of Nine Angles. There was a big, big fight over whether or not his beliefs constituted religious freedom, freedom of speech, or whether they were true extremist leanings and actions that showed he had radicalized. This is the first case. The most important thing about this case for me is that it was the first case, aside from the fact that this guy tried to frag a unit of a few dozen soldiers and do it in collaboration with Al-Qaeda, this is the first time the American government has had to make, the federal prosecutors have laid out what the Order of Nine Angles is and made a case for it as an extremist ideology in a court proceeding. So this is a precedent. That's in future cases. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, in Britain, I think you all have had, how many cases have you had that deal with O9A? It's like, well, it's quite a few, right?
It's quite a few, but our government for a while was apparently mulling over this idea that they'll be designated a terror organization. That's why they all sprung up and were like, oh, actually, we're something different now. Right. But that kind of died down.
Sure. But your courts and your prosecutors have some experience with this ideological framework, with this type of radicalization. This is the first time it's been laid out in the States. And it's interesting. It was fascinating to me because, you know, during the way that this hearing worked, in order to admit the evidence, the government had to bring in their expert witnesses. They had to basically show their case to the judge and to the defense in a series of hearings and motions that essentially kind of established what O9A was. And the testimony that they sought was that of Pete Seamy, who's a pretty well-known professor on right-wing extremism in Southern California. And he gave, I think he testified for an entire day in May about O9A. But anyway, the deal is that the government laid out what O9A is and how Melzer radicalized in this case. And it really, in several different ways, made it clear that they have a pretty decent grasp on the ideology and on what constitutes an adept, a follower, an adherent of this this particular branch of Satanism. And they've kind of built that out going forward. I think that, you know, in some ways, it was one of these test cases that indicate the sort of direction that federal counterterrorism efforts are going in certain respects. I know that there's a number of other active cases that we can discuss downrange that deal with O9A. They've popped up, the ideology's popped up a lot in connection with the Adam Waffen Division, but it wasn't really central to the charging of it. But Melzer, like in his in the demonstration of what he had done in the past, the government apparently located a couple people who he knew back in the day in Louisville, and had a couple witnesses that were prepared to testify that he had done, including one of his old roommates, that he had been in possession of a firearm. They'd seen the firearm that he had claimed to have shot so and so. During a drug deal gone wrong at this location. They were prepared to show physical evidence of the shooting that happened. And then there was witness testimony that would also claim to discuss, you know, the second robbery and shooting that he was involved in. There were no police reports on either one of those incidents. I actually put in requests to the Louisville Metropolitan Police Department for any and all crime reports that had to do with Ethan Melzer or with those locations and those times, and they came up blank. So these were unreported crimes, allegedly. It's unclear as to whether, you know, it's not, I can't confirm that they happened, but the feds had enough on it to put it into sworn filings in court that are filed under penalty of perjury. And they had witnesses that were prepared to testify. They were about 5 days out from going to trial with this evidence in hand. As insofar as the anti-fascist insight role, you know, this, you know, subterfuge that this guy allegedly did in while infiltrating an anti-fascist group in Louisville or wherever he was, all that exists about that are messages on Telegram to the effect. And I should mention that the bulk of the evidence on this case, a lot of the evidence on this case, was seized from Melzer's own devices, a couple iPhones and an iPad, I think an iPad that was found on his person at the base he was stationed in Venezia, Italy. And then the government also received a lot of information. I don't know how they received it from Telegram or of the Telegram channels that this guy was sitting in. So yeah, it's not, I think there's evidence in from the filings that Melzer was involved in prior, you know, prior bad acts, but you know, I haven't seen them myself. All I can rely on is the government's papers. But the guy took a guilty plea. He went down rather than face that evidence. So
yeah, that is interesting. And so do we know like what kind of verbatim or thereabouts, like what this guy was actually saying, what his plans were? Like we know vaguely, but like what was how engaged in this was he? Like this wasn't a fucking, you know, honey trap, you know, CIA type thing where they're like, hey, why don't you grab a bomb? Like, from what I understand, from what we were saying, this was like, he was directing this shit, right?
No, he was dead bent on it. I mean, yeah. He transmitted the radio frequencies that his unit would be broadcasting on, the direct route of their movement. He actually took from the filings, it looks like he took photographs from certain briefings that he was in or from classified materials about his base and the geographic features of it, the layout, and sent them on to the group. He discussed whether or not certain points of approach would be good for, say, a mortar attack or an ambush. Mm. He disclosed the type of armaments that his unit would have, you know, M4 rifle, light armaments. We're just talking rifles and maybe some portable mortars or something like that. But the defensive capabilities of that particular that particular unit weren't exactly strong. And he basically wanted to time the attack in a way that it would ensure maximum casualties.
And why? What was his reasoning? I know, you know, he was Order of Nine Angles, but what did he see this as, like a mass kind of human sacrifice or what?
I mean, I think so. I mean, I think he wanted to cause chaos. He certainly wanted to bring about the back and forth violence, the tit for tat, the reprisal violence that would ensue from a jihadi attack on an American unit in this region. Again, we don't know exactly where he was deployed. The government successfully applied for redactions or they have a protective order in the case about the location and the name of the base that this particular section of the 173rd was going to be deployed at. So it could have been, probably was in Syria, to be honest with you. It might have been, I can't think of, maybe you can't, maybe you're more familiar with this. I can't think of any American deployments in Southeast Turkey. That would be shocking to me, given how protective the Turkish military are of that region.
Well, when I read it, it did read like there was some kind of Turkish involvement, like you said, with the Bozkurts and whatever. And the only place would be like, the air.
Incirlik?
Yeah, exactly. Incirlik. Yeah, the air base. But even that didn't really make sense.
No, it didn't. I mean, Incirlik is not a small base. There's a lot of defensive armaments around there. I think they're, I mean, not just the American
military. They don't
really
patrol around there, right? Like, why would they?
No, they don't. No, and it's actually not an American. I don't believe the Americans have the authority to go on armed patrols outside that area because it's Turkish territory. They use Incirlik on a lease or a joint cooperation agreement through NATO with Turkey. So my read on this is that this was a deployment somewhere much further out. If there is an American deployment in Southeast Turkey, that would be very interesting. I think it was probably over the line in Syria, and there may have been some agreement to let either Americans pass through there, or they would fly into Iraq and then deploy north into that region. But yeah, I think that, you know, his general purpose was to sow chaos and to cause a mass casualty event and to bring about American reprisals in that region. And this is kind of part of this feeds into a general ethos in 09A, I think that's the best way to put it. Yeah. That they want to cause chaos. They want to sow this sort of bloodshed and madness where they go in order to kind of bring about destabilization. And you know, it's part of this obscure ideology that really values chaos and bloodshed and manipulation in order to grow. You know, for an individual to grow in strength and to become a stronger, more proficient adept of this ideology. Melzer had done a decent bit of reading. I'm not really clear how far he'd gotten in the books. I've seen some messages quoted from him about, the level of involvement that he had and this level of familiarity he had with certain texts and certain practices. He mentioned that he'd practiced culling well in the Job Corps.
Just to butt in there, sorry, Ali, for anyone that's not familiar, culling is a term the Order of Nine Angle Adherents use, basically meaning a human sacrifice. So they will kill the weak as a kind of sacrifice to the dark gods, that kind of shite. So he was saying he was involved in that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not... All they mentioned was like this... All that was in the filing was like a three-line, two-line... excerpt from Telegram. So I didn't have any more information about that. Part of the problem with the part of the issue in reporting on this case is that you're kind of looking at everything through a straw, because the feds have an enormous amount of information. We were talking on Melzer and that particular group, we were talking about terabytes in the courtroom that were in the government's possession. And there was a debate over, you know, can we turn over everything? We want to protect certain things. The defense wanted everything, but everything also meant that you would have to sift through an absolute mountain of evidence, because we're talking about months of very, very frequent communications through Telegram, months of chat logs and messages and video and God knows what else, and PDFs. So I can't really say, I don't have a great idea of how deep that understanding went. You kind of all only can look at it through the eyes of the court filings. But he certainly showed enough familiarity. There were a number of texts found on him, found on his, in his effects in his barracks when military police went in and seized his clothing, seized his belongings, including a bloodstained copy of, I want to say, the Sinister Tradition. Maybe it was Naus. But yeah, and there were photographs, you know, and filings the government produced indicating that he performed blood rituals with said texts, which would and sent them to the group, sent them to other members of that particular, I guess, Nexion. You know, the Nexion that he was allegedly part of was called Rapewaffen, which I guess is an important element that we should mention here. It was part of, you know, one. It's one of a couple, at least, far-right groups and online, at least online groups on Telegram, that bring about the idea of sexual assault and rape as a means of instilling fear in the general population, of controlling people, of manipulating them, of advancing, if they're O9A groups, which some of them are, Rapewaffen certainly was, of advancing their own status within that ideological pantheon or whatever you call it through sexual assault. It's very grim. It's nasty. It's gross, but it is entirely in keeping with some of the other materials that you and I have seen down the years from that corner of, the like internet world.
Well, they were calling it, I mean, there was an image out there. I forget, but it's like, It's the Order of Nine Angles pentagram, and then an inversed swastika, if I remember, which, you know, represents esoteric Nazism. And then it was a guy in a balaclava, and it said like militant rape or something like that. You know, like it was like using like rape as like I mean, not that I mean, I don't know if any of them had, but like using the saying that that's a good thing. That's a way to attack like the or whatever the fuck, like Judeo-Christian Magian order and all that bullshit that they come out with.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about an ideology that lionizes sexual abuse of children quite fairly and human sacrifice. And, you know, I mean, I believe that sexual assault is part of their, one of their rituals, right? It's part, it has been, maybe it's sexual assault, or there's like some sort of sexual activity that's part of rituals.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you look at some of the very early writings of Order of Nine Angles from the 70s and the 80s, they have like these very fucked up, how do I explain it? It's disgusting, but it's a kind of pedophilic fan fiction, if you like. You know, that was written by David Myatt, the leader of Order Nine Angles, the founder. A lot of fucked up shit like that. And in the British neo-Nazi group Sonnenkrieg, which was heavily inspired by Order of Nine Angles, to be honest, they were more Order of Nine Angles than they were Nazi at one point, if that makes sense. They were, one thing they were doing on their Discord channel when, you know, our group were looking into them was convincing young girls to, you know, pose nude, which, you know, they're fucking underage, it's pedophilic, and also convincing them to cut themselves, and then they would share these images as if it's like a fucking Pokemon card, you know what I mean? Like swapping, like, I got this one, I got it. Like, just unbelievable levels of disgusting shit. And it was real, like, it was all real, this has all been documented, the guys that did it are in prison now. Like, you know, it's very much a part of their sinister culture, even though you get these mouthpieces coming on Twitter and here, there and everywhere. Oh no, that's not what we believe in, you've misunderstood it. It's like, well, it's very much what you believe in. You know, you've been talking about this shit for like decades, and now that you have potential, like, you know, terror charges above your heads, you suddenly want to change track and say that there is no Order of Nine Angles is an esoteric ideology and not a specific worldview and whatever. Like, it's just nonsense.
Well, to that point, actually, I do want to get into a little bit of the reaction to not only Melzer's conviction, but about 2 weeks, 3 weeks before Melzer was convicted, I published a long piece on Rolling Stone in the June issue of Rolling Stone magazine about not just Ethan Melzer's case, but the ways in which, you know, a lot of the texts that he was involved in were from the Temple of Blood, which is an American O9A Nexion run by Joshua Caleb Sutter. We've talked about him before on this podcast. we wrote about him when we were doing, you know, our investigations into the Adam Waffen division. Sutter has been a FBI paid informant, paid confidential informant since 2004, I believe, 2003 or 2004. And, you know, the piece kind of got into the back and forth over Sutter and how the feds essentially turned a blind eye to him being involved in the spread and propagation of Onane ideology, imagery, just the general ethos of that, ideology, that those beliefs into the, how they've kind of spread throughout the far right. In the reactions that we were able to see from, like, I believe they're posted on Fenrir and a couple, you know, these random Twitter accounts that seem to be members of the, I think there are, there might be somebody who's an Oxonian, who's a member of the, an Oxford Nexion of O9A.
Yeah.
There's a couple others as well, but there was kind of this general pushback saying, oh, this is all Sutter's dark magic. You know, he's trying to discredit our movement. It was a shifting of the blame onto Melzer and then, onto Sutter. And then there was also a little bit of back and forth about, oh, you know, our movement has been smeared in the media and now we're getting all this sort of this attention that's really harsh on us. But I genuinely believe that a lot of that has to do, Jake, with the fact that the government in the remarks in the courtroom, like, Melzer pled guilty to being a member of it, to participating in a conspiracy to commit an act of terrorism, which the federal prosecutor made a point of putting on the record his allegiance and adherence to the Order of Nine Angles. So essentially that's a terrorism conviction that's tied not only to Al-Qaeda, but to O9A and its precedent. And for, I think, you know, a lot of the O9A adherents, they're not stupid people. They're twisted, they're macabre, they're fucked up, but they're not stupid and they understand. You know, they built this really complex, multi-layered kind of, I guess, puzzle box of an ideology, of a belief system. And it's not hard for them to understand that a federal terrorism conviction that establishes a significant precedent for what their group is about and the fact that it is an extremist radicalizing ideology in the US is a very serious development for them.
Right. And what main... like evidence did the court present to say, like, yeah, this guy is O9A. This was an O9A attack.
Well, it was interesting. They described O9A, you know, they deftly during the, in the criminal complaint, the government did list a bunch of different elements of O9A, Satanist, far right, overlapping with neo-Nazi beliefs, Islamic jihadist beliefs, and then anarchist beliefs, which, you know, you can take, do believe that their terming of anarchist is not like the Daniel Guerin, Kropotkin variant. They're just looking at it as a nihilistic sort of belief. I think nihilistic would have been a better characterization, but they're feds, they're cops. Of course they want to paint anarchists as extremists because they charge anarchists and they have their own worldview. So, you know, take that as you will, but there isn't, you know, it has to be said that there is a point of connection between, I mean, not just a point of connection, there are several points of connection between far-right ideology and Islamic jihadism, which, you know, are embodied in the person of David Mayet, who converted to Islam. When did he convert to Islam? Like 2001, 2003, and then started espousing those worldviews. There have been significant overlaps between other white supremacist groups and jihadis over the years, just in terms of an anti-systemic, you know, anti-Jewish worldview, just this idea of trying to make common cause about, you know, enemies, similar enemies. But Mayet himself actually did write quite a bit about the connection. You know, his writings as a self-purported jihadi were pretty important in the movement. Am I correct about that?
Yeah. He wrote this whole... like this real
treatise, right?
Well, he wrote this gushing piece about like Osama bin Laden and the 9/11 attacks and like how great they were, and you know, but he has since, you know, he's since come out and be like, oh, I don't believe in any of that anymore and I'm really sorry for all of that shit. But but he's very much it's they think they're like extremely clever in their way. They're like, oh, but is he involved? It's like, yeah, there's a mountain of evidence. In fact, I have, I just brought it up because to remind myself. So there is a, fuck, one second, where is it? So from a magazine published by the Sorcerer's Apprentice bookstore in Leeds in the 1980s. So there's this whole thing written by David Meyer, and it's literally titled D. Meyer of the Order of Nine Angles Writes of Magic Debunked, an Alternative View. And, you know, it's this stuff. He says, oh, fundamentally, the Kabbalah is a farce. It no more represents the cosmos. Deriving from, you know, like, he's fully... And the point to that is that, like, that this, you know, he's into serious, you know, like, serious, violent, evil magic, you know. Like, he wrote a piece. It says it in Naos as well. Like, he wrote this thing, or under the pen name Anton Long, which they go by, which Mayak goes by. He wrote a thing saying, like, you know, we don't need this kind of wishy-washy, you know, edgy atheism, which, you know, Satanism has become. And, you know, I kind of agree there, that's mad cringe. But he's like, his argument was like, no, we don't need that. We need, like, real evil, believing in demons. They're real. They're in a different realm. Galactic Reich, like, all this mad fucking shit. Yeah, and like I said, my point is there's, like, you know, there's whole texts from the 80s published by David Meyer under his real name. He just thought they'd all vanished, but, you know, in fact, who got this? So the Empire Never Ended, they unearthed this piece of writing. It wasn't me, but it's, yeah, it's really good. So, you know, there's a lot of evidence that ties him all back to this, like, to the point where, you know, it would probably, I'm certain it would stand up in court if they ever wanted to, like, convict him of something.
The government, the Americans actually cite Myatt as the founder of O9A.
There you go. Yeah,
this,
yeah.
Throughout these hearings, in fact, that was done during Pete Seamy's, that was Pete Seamy who actually testified as such in the evidentiary hearing, I believe. And then it was brought back at some other point in the proceedings. Now, I mean, it's, you know, this case, we're just, it's, I think there was a concerted plan, aside from the fact that they needed to charge Melzer, once they realized how new this material was, there was a concerted plan that the prosecutors at the Southern District of New York, who are, by the way, very good at charging out this sort of case, at charging out national security and terrorism cases. They've done it for jihadis. They've done it for left-wing groups. They've done it for right-wing groups. They've done it for people. I think Victor Bout's conviction was out of the Russian arms dealer, who's now being traded back to Russia for an American basketball player, female American basketball player. You know, he was convicted out of this court, and the office is very careful about how they put together their cases, and they also do it with a view to what will come next, to how this ideology will crop up next. So this is it's a really important case, and I think for the U.S., and because the SDNY has a long arm, like, they can charge anybody anywhere, and they can also, like, if this is basically like the tip of the spear for the American criminal justice system going abroad, like, trying to charge people out and hold them accountable in American courts. Mm-hmm. I was actually surprised that Melzer's conviction didn't get more coverage, and his case, you know, he got a lot of coverage when he got arrested, but this stuff is really hard for people to understand. You know, it's not as easy as, like, oh, this is some dude dressed up in yellow and black and punching people at a, you know, at a bar in Portland, Oregon, or at the Capitol on January 6th. It's not a Proud Boy. It's something a little bit similar.
It's much
something different. Darker, more complex. Yeah. That really actually feeds, you know, it feeds into a lot of very troubling, like, lethal strains of the far right.
Yeah, and he's this isn't the first like O9A linked military guy, right?
You know. He is, this is interesting. So he is, the groups he was associated with, I'm not clear if the next person in which I'm going to talk about was O9A, because the filings are relatively new, but okay. There was a Marine, an ex-Marine who was actually discharged from service, I want to say in 2021, named Matthew Bellinger, who served on a base in Hawaii, I believe. He has been charged by the government as part of a plot to, he's been charged with firearm offenses, buying, you know, straw purchase of a firearm through apparently a police officer from an unknown agency in his home back on Long Island in New York, a suburb east of New York. That's just, it's like a big, sandbar that extends east into the Atlantic from basically from the East River in Manhattan. Brooklyn and Queens are on the western edge of it, and it extends out. And once you get out beyond Queens and once you get out beyond the city line, it's just cop land. There's so many cops that live out there from NYPD, and like there are firearms offenses they get charged with, domestic violence, abuse, all this shit. It's known for being an area where right-wing groups kind of breed. And this guy, former Marine Matthew Bellinger, as part of the court filings that came out, I want to say last month or earlier this month, he was allegedly engaging in plots to, training with other people in the woods in Long Island to attack a synagogue, training with firearms, planning, to attack Jews and shit like that, as part of a group called Rape Creek, that according to the filings of the federal government, shared members between Rape Waffen Division, which is the group that Ethan Melzer kind of made common cause with, the 09A Nexion, and the Adam Waffen Division. So they shared ideology and members between those three groups. I don't know who they are. They're not made clear in the filings, but Bellinger is, he was arrested earlier this summer and extradited from Long Island back to Hawaii, where he's now facing federal charges. And the filings, the sort of shit that he's stating out, he wrote out an entire manifesto where, again, rape, sexual assault is described as a means to cow non-whites, to cow the Jews into submission, to fear white individuals, to, make clear the superiority of our race. It's really noxious ideology. And the crazy shit, Jake, is that this dude, Bellinger, a lot of the evidence the government gathered on him dates from before he joined the military.
Right.
This guy passed the screening. he passed the screens in order to get into the Marine Corps, which, has been a big problem. They've had a long time issue with making sure that extremists don't find their way into the American armed forces. It appears that he wanted to get into the armed forces as part of his own development and training and like advancement of his right-wing beliefs and goals. Again, the depth of his ideology has not been made clear. I haven't seen any search warrant returns that indicate what was found at his home, but I will say that the feds found something like 1,900 documents, videos, and PDFs on his devices that had to do with the far right. So this is somebody who is pretty, he's up to his eyeballs in it. And we did reporting on Vasilis Pistolis, this serving member of the U.S. Marine Corps who's a member of the Adam Waffen Division, and attacked Emily Gorsinski and a bunch of other left-wing activists on the night before the at Charlottesville, the University of Virginia campus, on the night before Heather Heyer was murdered in 2017. There have been other soldiers down the years. It's an ongoing problem in the armed forces, not just in the U.S., but, France, the U.K. It's an ongoing issue that they'll always gravitate towards the armed forces in order to kind of build up their cadre and their own reputations. But yeah, this guy, Bellinger's case is a really good one. Yeah, it is the same orbit. I mean, it's not necessarily it's not always hand in hand, but law enforcement and the armed forces are breeding grounds for these ideologies. And they always have been, and unfortunately always will be. Bellinger's case is interesting. From the evidence, it's not really clear to me, but it looks like it stems from the same sort of casework. The timing checks out that it stems from the same sort of casework as the Melzer case. The case originated in the Eastern District of New York, which is the federal jurisdiction. So the way that federal law enforcement breaks up in the states for non-Americans and for Americans who don't understand it, which is fine. It's not something you expect to interact with on the day-to-day. Each state breaks their jurisdiction up into geographic districts. For instance, California is a great example. Northern District of California, San Francisco up to the Oregon border. Eastern District of California is Sacramento up to the Oregon border on the eastern side of I-5, I believe, with the interstate, and then down to about Bakersfield. Central District is Los Angeles out to the Inland Empire, to the Nevada and Arizona borders. Southern District is San Diego. In New York, you have the Southern District, which is Manhattan, up through the Bronx and a big chunk of the central state. And the Western District is like the Southern tier out to Ohio, Sorry, Jake, I'm giving you a bit of a geography lesson. All right.
That's good. It's good.
Yeah. Northern District is like far northern New York, Albany. I believe it's Albany up to up to Canada. And then the Eastern District is Brooklyn, Queens, and Long Island, which are actually, you know, Brooklyn and Queens are the center of New York City's population. They're each over 2 million people in population each. And Long Island is a very densely populated region. I mean, or heavily populated region that, you know, probably has, I think, another couple million people in it. So the Eastern District generated the Bellinger case. It's being prosecuted in Hawaii because I believe that's where his offenses took place.
Yeah.
The alleged straw purchase, but the timing does make the timing and the overlap of the group that he was allegedly part of with this rape Waffen division. That makes me think that it stemmed from the Melzer investigation at some point or another, the same squad or the same source, who knows, but it's, I think what it does indicate, you know, getting through the whole criminology of it and zooming out to the big picture, what I think it does indicate is that the American law enforcement apparatus, especially the federal law enforcement apparatus, has gotten its head around a certain type of, you know, siege culture, 09A, what some call accelerationist worldview. And they've kind of figured out, they have decent sources right now, and they've managed to get across quite a few individuals and groups. And in their court filings, they actually show a pretty good understanding of it, which is a very sharp contrast, I got to say, to about half a decade ago. And it makes sense, right? They've thrown resources at it. There's no longer a right-wing extremist in power anymore. The Justice Department can go forward and make larger cases and do more sprawling investigations into right-wingers and not fear political interference from the top, which we have seen, you know, did happen during the Trump years. And it's, you know, I think it really speaks to the level of resources that they've thrown at this, the manpower. It looks like some of these prosecutors have been doing their reading. They've been eating their vegetables. Same thing with the feds. Again, you know, what comes of it downrange, we'll see, have to see with that. But, and there have been some really horrific attacks earlier this year. The Buffalo massacre is a case in point of that. And God knows what groups that dude was overlapping in. But we've kind of gotten to an interesting point here in like the far right universe in the States, whereby, you know, individuals are more, they're trending away from grouping up. Like getting involved in a group is kind of seen as, hey, look, that's either an op or the people that you're with are just, they're asking to get caught. There's a drift more towards individual self-radicalization and action, like the shooter in Buffalo. And that, I think, is evidence. I mean, we've seen some stuff to that effect in our research, no?
Yeah, I think honestly, like this, like you said, like the police and the feds or whatever, they seem to have like more of a grasp on this than they did when we were looking into it like 3 or 4 years ago now. But I think you're right that like the real, not real danger, it's all dangerous, like, but I think you're more likely to see an attack from a non-affiliated lone wolf guy. I mean, we've seen that is true. But maybe just because it's easier for them to not get caught before they go out and do their shit. Like, I think they all have the same intention, of course, but the ones that are doing like lone wolf, okay, they get these texts, they read these manifestos, but they're not like talking to others the same way that maybe like a group that is fucking trying to get his unit bombed. Like, yeah, it's, I'm not surprised he got caught, you know what I'm saying? Whereas a guy that goes, okay, today's the day, boom, out he goes, guns everyone down. Like, that shit is very hard to stop.
Buffalo is a great example of that.
Yeah.
You know, there's still an element of that incident that we're still waiting to hear more about a few months downrange, which is that there was a former, a retired federal law enforcement officer in the chat group where this attack, where the attacker, where the assailant announced that he was going kinetic.
Yeah.
And we don't know why that guy was there. Well, yeah, he certainly wasn't on an op.
No. Yeah, exactly. But the interesting thing as well, from the Buffalo Shooters Manifesto, I read it. Obviously research. I read it, and there's a bit where he's like, I'm not a member of any specific group, but there's a lot that I admire and support. Yeah. So I think that really backs up the thing of like, okay, even if they're not
in their Discords or they're chatting to these groups directly, or they're not startup members, they're still seeing their shit. They're, you know, like the Siege Culture stuff undoubtedly came across his path and, you know, undoubtedly inspired him to do what he's doing, because he did what basically they say to do. You know what I'm saying? So it all connects, I think.
It was also like, it was the design, I believe, from what I remember of it, it had like Fash Wave aesthetics and all that shit. It was very much of the milieu. And you know, there's some documents that are circulating now, and certain channels that I kind of pop my head into every now and then just to get a flavor of what the radicalization sphere is like and what sort of stuff these younger and older and, you know, whatever age far right wingers are using to kind of drive, gee themselves up. And, you know, it's strange. It now is, it's kind of like Columbiner culture, you know, there are visual cues. You don't even have to get into like the text anymore. There are a set of visual cues. There's a series, there's a pantheon now of faces that you'll clearly recognize. You know, this quote unquote saints like Tarrant and Dylan Roof and Sam Woodward and all these other folks that, you know, you aspire to. And then, you know, it's interesting, like the ideology doesn't even seem to be very clear cut anymore.
No,
it's not gonna be a mishmash of like, there are elements of Siege Culture, there's elements of National Socialism, there's degrowth elements in there that either come from, like, one could say eco-anarchism or
eco-fascism,
Ted Kaye. Like, how do you get across, what do you make of that?
Well, yeah, it's an amalgamation. I think it's like the kind of logical end to all of these different ideologies fighting each other. We're the right ones, we're the right ones, join this group, join that one. You know, like they say, movementarianism is no good. I mean, ironically, kind of Siege and Atom often said that and then kind of became a part of that. But like, I mean, very specifically. Yeah, yeah. But I think the, you know, it's a logical kind of like, I don't know, like, not the climax, because the climax was all the arrests and them getting, you know, right, the Antwolf and killing people. But I guess like the resurgence, I guess, of that is, yeah, these groups just go, okay, well, let's, you know, we don't have a specific leader now because they're all in prison, or Slavros has left, or, you know, whatever, or they're lying low. So it's like, well, now they can just amalgamate like different parts of different ideologies. And it doesn't really matter if they don't all follow the same thing. I think they've realized they can just be like, well, yeah, well, we just do a killing. You know, like, I mean, Breivik's a good example. When Breivik did his, you know, horrific mass shooting, mass murder, he was a Zionist at the time, an open Zionist. Now, I think he's actually said, I'm a National Socialist. But, you know, it either way, it doesn't matter for them. They still lauded him as this hero, despite him being an ardent supporter of their biggest enemy. You know what I mean? But again, it's they worship action over everything. So that's why you'll see, you know, you'll see the fact that they'll ignore some, I don't know, so maybe there's a left-wing militant that did something. They'll kind of ignore what his ideology was and what that he would have thought of them or she would have thought of them. And they'll just be like, well, the action itself is what matters. And that is what we're seeing a lot more of, I think, from what I've noticed now.
It really does. Reviewing these files, just trying to pull them apart, figure out what countries they come from, what the backgrounds of the people who are writing them might be, what their ideological or practical sources might be, where else these images or this aesthetic may have come from.
Well, let's talk about this in the bonus episode. So let's get into that. Why not? Right. If people want to hear it, patreon.com/popularfront. But yeah, so yeah, that was really interesting. Do you want to tell people where they can, first, I think, direct people to the written article you did for this on Rolling Stone. It's great, really detailed. And then, you know, where people can contact you, get in touch, whatever.
Sure. So, the piece that I did for Rolling Stone about Ethan Melzer and the Order of Nine Angles and Joshua Caleb Sutter, there was a longer piece that I did. The feature is June 5th, 2022. It's on their website, rollingstone.com. The Satanist Neo-Nazi Plot to Murder U.S. Soldiers. And then once Melzer pled guilty, I actually wrote up a account of that hearing and just kind of pulled back on the larger significance that we discussed earlier. And that piece came out on July 6th on the Rolling Stones website, and it's titled Neo-Nazi Satanist Cult is a Terrorist Group, Feds Say. Kind of says it all, doesn't it, fellas? So that's, those are those articles. You can find my writing. You can find me on Twitter at A Winston. My email is on there, in my signature, ali.winston@protonmail.com. My colleague, Darwin Bond Graham and I, we actually, just finished up a book, that's coming out in January about, the history of the Oakland Police Department and the possibility or futility of police reform in the US. It's called The Riders Come Out at Night. And that's also in my bio. It will be on sale in January. It's on pre-sale, pre-order now. That's the other thing that I do, actually. I have spent a long, long time looking at, law enforcement, the criminal justice system, brutal cops, dirty cops, corrupt cops, broken systems. Yeah, cops, just police, right? That's it. I was not an extremism reporter. I was mostly a criminal justice reporter before the Trump years. And then, you know, shit just took me in this direction. So it's kind of, this is the other thing that I do. So yeah, if you want to pre-order the book, there's a link in my bio as well.
All right, man. Nice one. That was journalist Ali Winston talking to us about the situation where a US soldier who is a Order of Nine Angles adherent and therefore neo-Nazi occultist tried to blow up his whole fucking unit. It's a mad story, but like I said, we've just covered it. It's real, and that's the state of the world at the moment. There we go. If you like what we're doing here at Popular Front, please do consider supporting us on the Patreon. We need all the support we can get. We are growing rapidly. The momentum is flying, but the Patreon ain't really growing. So it's very hard to kind of match the momentum with work. Partly that's mostly due to censorship via YouTube. Our documentaries are all censored now, so it's very difficult for us to, you know, kind of organically grow. We have to like constantly be like, hey, watch this, look at this, share this. So yeah, if you want to support us, patreon.com/popularfront. For just $5 a month, you get bonus episodes, usually two a month. It's like a whole different podcast. There are hundreds there. For the other tiers, you get access to the Discord. There's a whole series on there kind of educating people on what to do and what not to do if they want to be a journalist. There's video extras, loads of stuff on there. Patreon.com/popularfront. Or you can buy our t-shirts. That funds a lot of our work. Go to popularfront.shop. Or if you want, you can donate another way. Go to popularfront.co/support. There's many different options there. Thank you to our sponsors. They are Oracle Coffee Shop in Portland, Oregon, USA. They're an independent coffee business selling only fair trade products. See them at 3875 Southwest Bond Avenue, 97239. The next one, Grindcore House, a pair of independent coffee shops in Philadelphia, USA, one in South, one in West. Find them on socials at Grindcore House. And Propagandopolis, an outlet selling and writing about historical conflict propaganda from around the world. You can buy prints at propagandopolis.com. Use the promo code PopularFront10 for 10% off. Follow us on our social media, Instagram at popular.front, Twitter at popularfront_, YouTube, just go to youtube.com/popularfront. And we are on TikTok, but already we got like the full amount of fucking strikes before we get kicked off there now already. So if you want, you could look on there, maybe share our shit. That might help us, but we don't really fuck around with it anymore. But yeah, it's, I don't know what it is, like tiktok.com. I think it's /@popular.front. Yeah. Weird CCP spy app, but there you go. We're trying to relay traffic to the YouTube, but yeah, we already nearly got banned on there. So yeah, I don't know. If you want to basically find any of the episodes, any links to anything, just go to www.popularfront.co. You'll just see links to everything you need there. If you want to follow me on socials, it's at @Jake_Hanrahan, HanraHan. I've mostly been taking a break from that shit recently, so if you tried to get hold of me, I've not replied. Apologies. Maybe my website, jakehanrahan.com, maybe email me there for whatever. What else? Oh yeah, music in this episode, the intro is by Home and the outro is by Sam Black. You can hear his music at samblackpf.com. As usual, thank you to the high tier Patreons. They are Bradley Hope, Wizard Actual, Claire Hoffbauer, Benjamin Topper, Chongus Bongwater,
Elijah Finley, Siddhartha O, Cameron Collins, Q Loves Cake Farts, Nicholas Blomberg, Matthew Diffley, Noah Schmidt, Jane Milichip, Claire, Liana, Sean Christianovich, NTHG, Arturo Rafael Macias, Ethan Zwick, Champagne Anarchist, Elise Middlefart, David McManus, Tom Petrie, James Leons, Lisa Milgram, Bradley Davies, No Dogs, No Hamsters, Brennan Crave, B, Drift, Kyle Morris, RX, Tiki Lover, Cherry, Ben Marshall, Dallas Dunn, Shakir Gupta, LD50 Seattle. The LD50 Seattle, they're a fucking cool punk band. If you just look them up, LD50 Seattle, they made a song about Popular Front. It's like punk hardcore, but it's actually fucking good. Not that, you know, punk hardcore isn't good, but like they're really good. Check them out, look them up. Kay Glitter Vulcan, Bethany Swoveland, Adam H, Ryan Barbadillo, Derivative Fool, Paula Water, Larson 8669, Ivan Julien, Bjorn Kirsten, Diamond Steen, Michael O'Connor, Jack Doherty, Nicholas Butter, JD, Jav, James Cully, Tynan Daly, Ethan, Shanklin the Painter, Fitz Madrid, Ed Coulthard, Mike Barone, Ben, Scott Hopton, Chris Cusimano, Degenerate Zero Alpha, Giorgio Arani, DR, Trey Nance, Amy R, Rubicon, Frank Austin, Amelia Mee, Nawa Ees, Christina Rivetti, Freya Northman, Noah, Andrew Hurley, Vida Provost, Brian McLaughlin, Tom Lochrin, Young Wasabi, Tony Bin, Adam Bergsnyder, JL, Stephen Davila, Dan Dunham, Fletcher, Chad Walker, Diana Govanek, Lawrence Abrahams, What Bitcoin Did with Peter McCormick, Christopher Martin, Ryan Sandercock, and Moritz Zumwalt. Thank you all so much. Really appreciated. Patreon.com/popularfront.